It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In the digital age, word spreads fast, and that can be a blessing and a curse. As WPR's Daniel Kading reports, a review of the Husky refinery explosion found social media caused confusion for emergency crews trying to evacuate people from Superior this past April.
When an explosion at Husky Oil refinery punctured an asphalt tank and sparked fires in April, Julia Johnson was working at home about 3 miles away.
That one doesn't really latch.
This one doesn't really either. It's an old... This is an addition.
Johnson works at a Duluth nonprofit that gives people information in a disaster or an emergency. But it was Johnson who needed information about what was going on after black smoke began filling the sky over the refinery. People were being told to evacuate, but Johnson says checking Facebook and news websites, it wasn't clear what areas were in the evacuation zone.
I checked one page and it said within 1 mile of the explosion. One said 1 to 3, and then both of them said 3 to 5.
News reports weren't helping straighten it out.
If you're 10 miles south and within 2 or 3 miles to the northeast and west of the Husky Oil refinery.
Anyone within 5 miles of that facility is now being asked to evacuate.
3 miles on either side, on all sides to the north, east, and west of the refinery, and then 10 miles to the south.
Residents from 3 miles around have been told to evacuate.
Douglas County Emergency Management Director Keith Kessler says there was a lot of confusion about the evacuation area that day. A report on the emergency response points to social media.
Information that was not 100% accurate got out that perhaps caused the evacuation zone to be a little larger than it was originally intended to be. Working with social media can be very difficult. It's hard to control.
A lot of agencies and people were giving out different evacuation orders on Twitter and Facebook, like the National Weather Service and the Superior Police Department. Even Superior Mayor Jim Payne shared evacuation information that wasn't quite right. But he says social media and confusion go hand in hand.
I'm just not feeling terribly apologetic for either myself or anybody else that issued an order for doing so. Once they saw danger, they told people to get out of danger and they gave them the best information they could at the time that they had it.
If the same thing happened today, Payne says they would respond better. He and other agencies have gone through training so that everyone knows their roles in an emergency. Douglas County's Kessler says many had already been through that training, but they're improving how they work together. That includes designating a single point person to share information.
We're going to work more to try to develop a better public information program to try to get everyone saying the same thing at a similar time.
Kessler says there's always a few wild cards, but he feels the emergency response went pretty much by the book. But that's no comfort to Johnson, who returned home that night thinking the fire was out and the evacuation order had been lifted.
They had put it out like a little bit, but it had restarted. So the evacuation was still on until like 9 a.m. for the next day.
Superior Police tweeted the evacuation would last about 2 more hours after the fire was put out that night, but later corrected that post. Johnson says they were trusting emergency crews and city leaders to give them the best information to keep them safe.
I would prefer if they don't know. They say they don't know, and they say it's indefinite because they're putting people's lives at risk, putting out wrong information.
And the actual evacuation area that day? The county's report said it was a 1 mile radius around the refinery, 10 miles south, and 3 miles east and west of the southern evacuation line.
Daniel Kading reported when the explosion, fire, and evacuations were breaking news. Since then, she's been following how the emergency has shaped the community. She's Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Superior, and she joins us now on the morning show. Danny, thank you for talking with us today.
Hi, John.
So what new information did this report bring to light?
Basically, it focused a lot on communications and what was a challenge for emergency crews at that time. You know, social media, as you just heard, was one part of it, but it was also a border issue, as you heard earlier in the hour, with the radio systems that Wisconsin and Minnesota use. Minnesota has a system that's called ARMOR, and Wisconsin has a system that's called WISCOM. And those two radio systems work on different frequencies. So that meant that a Duluth firefighter or a Duluth cop couldn't communicate with a Superior firefighter or a Superior cop. So they had to pair people up with the radio so that they would be able to communicate. That's been resolved. But, you know, a lot of the report focused on the communication and ways that they could improve things moving forward, some of the strengths that they saw that day with the response, and training and tabletop exercises and more understanding surrounding what happens in an emergency and what structure guides that response.
One takeaway from the report is that conflicting information spread on social media caused a lot of confusion about who needed to evacuate Superior. How did that happen?
Well, I think, you know, things were happening fast in an emergency. And so basically you had a lot of people who were on the ground over at the refinery watching the first fire and trying to answer questions and different agencies responding. Douglas County gave out the official evacuation area that day, and they say that that got misinterpreted by various agencies who were posting information online. And that information was updated throughout the day. You know, in an emergency, things change, and they try to communicate the best that they can.
So what did Superior residents you spoke to have to say about this?
Well, I mean, they spoke about their confusion with what was going on that day. The person I spoke with, Julie Johnson, they live about 3 miles away from the refinery, and they don't watch TV. So they were looking online on news websites and Facebook to try and figure out what was going on. And so, you know, it turns out that Johnson wouldn't have had to evacuate at all, because it was just that 1 mile around the refinery. Nobody north of 28th Street here in Superior would have needed to evacuate that day. But, you know, a number of people beyond that line, including university students, had to go over to Duluth because information changed that was going out.
Yeah, at one point, the university itself was kind of a rallying point for people to go to who had evacuated. And then all of a sudden, it looked like the line had shifted. And there was just the conflicting messages on social media actually affected the actual evacuation, didn't they?
Yes. Yeah, because the actual evacuation area got expanded by social media, they let that continue because they didn't want to put out information and then have people being confused and coming back into an area that wasn't safe. So they thought it was better to just let it grow rather than having people come into the area that they didn't want them to be.
Okay. So did the report have any suggestions for how to avoid this kind of confusion in the future?
Yeah, I mean, one of them is training and better understanding of the Emergency Operations Center and the Incident Command Structure. You know, I think emergency services here in Superior and Duluth, they all had that background. They all knew what to do and where to go in an emergency. But some of the other, you know, outliers that became involved, like the school district and government leaders, maybe didn't have as much of that background. So they've gone through training since then to educate people about this is your role, this is where the incident command center is, and this is where you go if you need information about what to do. I'm sorry, John, I already forgot the first part of your question.
Well, so did I. Let's move on. I was thinking as this whole thing was unfolding, comparisons to when the tank car full of benzene went into the Nemadji River back in the early 1990s, and right. And how the way information gets exchanged and posted for people to look at has really changed a lot in the last 25 or 30 years. So, you know, is there a sense that social media could be helpful, but it needs to be better managed?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, John, is that they're trying to improve their public information response. So basically, you had all these people who were giving out different information. And once the incident command structure, that emergency response formed, there was no unified voice putting out information. There were still people acting independently. So now they're going to be coordinating more and consulting with each other more to share information and designating public information officer or officers to give out that information.
And very quickly, as we close here, what are you watching for next as you continue to follow this story?
The investigations and lawsuits that are pending. You know, OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, has wrapped up their work on the site, and they said their investigation would take about 6 months to see what happened with worker safety. Of course, the Chemical Safety Board is doing their investigation. So we should be seeing some more information probably soon, I'm going to guess within the next month.
All right, Danny, thank you so much for being with us this morning. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, John.
Danielle Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Superior. She reported on the ground in April when an explosion and fire happened at the Husky Oil Refinery, and she's following the story as it affects the community. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Are teens suffering more anxiety today? And if that's true, are smartphones to blame? My guest says no, and we're going to find out why. Do you think increased time spent with tech has changed the way young people today think and interact with the world? Or do you think they're the same as older generations, just more tech savvy? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Three ways to get in touch. My guest is Richard Friedman, a professor of clinical psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times. He recently wrote an article titled, "The Big Myth About Teenage Anxiety." Professor Friedman, good morning and welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So we hear that smartphones and the internet are changing the way our brains work, particularly the elastic growing minds of young people, but that may not be really the whole picture. Why?
Well, I mean, it is true that we are neuroplastic, meaning that our brains are open to influence from outside, environmental stimuli, and especially when we're young, when we're in the so-called, sensitive period, when we're uniquely susceptible to changes. But at the same time, our brains are fairly sturdy, and we have built-in mechanisms to prevent too much influence from the outside. You're not going to wipe out your brain as if it were a hard drive and reformat it by exposure to these technologies. And I think that, people have the idea that kids who are exposed to a lot of smartphones and digital technology are fundamentally changing their brain in a way that, previous generations who were exposed to other influences were not. And I think there is very little evidence scientifically that that's the case.
One of the concerns we hear a lot about when it comes to teens and tech is that constant access to social media and the internet is making them more prone to anxiety. Is that true?
There have been a lot of reports first, to just unpack what you said, that teens are more anxious now than they used to be. And everybody hears stories about the epidemic of teenage anxiety. But when I looked into this, there's actually very little evidence that the rates of anxiety disorders are rising in teenagers, either in the United States or around the world. So where this idea for the epidemic is coming from is not clear to me. So that's the first thing. And the second is, the relationship between anxiety in teenagers and their exposure to technology, I think, is murky at best. A lot of that comes from these studies where they look at a group of adolescents and ask them, how much time do you spend on your smartphone? And then they look at the rates of complaints of anxiety in teenagers, and then they link those two, and they're correlated. But as you know and your listeners know, things that are correlated are not necessarily causally related. So, you know, it could be that, you know, anxious teenagers who are anxious to start with spend more time on their smart devices is a way to allay their anxiety, and that, you know, their time on the smartphone is not the cause, it's the result of their anxiety.
Well, and isn't part of this the discussion and some of the confusion about how we use language? So the term anxiety has a specific meaning for mental health professionals, but as a more general term, it really doesn't mean the same thing. And so could it be that we're talking about two different things? I mean, teenagers, as near as I know, have always had some sort of anxiety, but not necessarily at the pathological level.
That's a wonderful point that you make, and I think the critical one. And I mean, the notion that people have a problematic anxiety, you have to understand that, you know, pathological anxiety or having an anxiety disorder means either having anxiety when there's really nothing to be worried about, so it's not appropriate to the situation, or it's excessive. You know, it's just wildly in out of proportion to the situation. That's an anxiety disorder, and it interferes with function. Kids can't go to school. They can't maintain their relationships. It gets in the way. That's pathological anxiety. Whereas, you know, normal anxiety is you're worried because something actually is upsetting. You're not doing well in school. Your friends don't like you. You had a bad date. You're afraid because there's been a terrorist attack. I mean, that's normal. And, you know, if you're not anxious in those settings, there's something else that's wrong. So, you know, kids and teens and adults should be anxious in certain settings. I guess the question is, you know, are teens now as a group more anxious, you know, within the normal range of anxiety than teens 10 or 20 years ago? That's a different question. It's not what I was talking about.
So what do we know? I mean, some studies have shown a negative correlation between time spent on screens and psychological well-being. But what you're saying is that those correlations really aren't, I don't want to say aren't valid, but it'd be like saying, okay, so all of these people also drank milk as babies and now they're more anxious. So those two things must be related.
Right. So, I mean, correlation is not nothing. I don't want to dismiss out of hand the possibility that, you know, someday somebody will do a careful study longitudinally and follow a group of kids, the same group of kids, and look at their baseline, you know, state of wellness and anxiety, and then be able to show over time that, you know, even kids who started out with low anxiety ended up with more of it, and it was directly related to exposure to digital technology. But the studies that we have right now are what we call cross-sectional studies. So you get a group of people, you look at them right now, and you look at how many hours on the phone they spend and how anxious they report they are. And then you link those two things. And that kind of a study can't control for what they were like before. And it can't rule out the possibility that the direction of cause goes the other way, that people who are more anxious to start with are more likely to use digital technology, or if they're more depressed, they're more likely to, you know, spend time on their cell phones. There's no way to figure that out from these studies.
What have you seen in your own patients? I mean, have you noticed any changes in young people as tech has become more and more pervasive in our everyday lives?
I have noticed that young people seem more worried in ways that, you know, I have not seen before. And not just that, I've seen, and this may be related to certain social classes, but that their parents are also more worried about them and worried about their future and worried that they're going to do well and concerned about, you know, how they're doing in ways that previous generations weren't. I mean, for example, you know, I'm 62 years old. I grew up in the, you know, 60s and 70s. My parents didn't know where I was and where my sister was after school. We were wandering around the neighborhood. We were hanging out with friends. You just never see that today. The world today, to many people, seems like a more unfriendly, scarier place. and kids are much more carefully observed and controlled. There is a sense of the world that is different now than it was then, and that may reflect the fact that, you know, there's a loss of neighborhood or family structure. However you want to speculate about why that is, I think people are generally more concerned, even though we hear all the time the world is safer. You know, homicide rates are down, crime has gone down, and yet you have this phenomenon of, you know, at least in certain social groups, of helicopter parents who are, you know, hovering mm-hmm. in the background, worried about their kids.
Right, and technology gives them greater access to where their children are. We're talking with Richard Friedman, professor of clinical psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times. His article titled "The Big Myth About Teenage Anxiety" is the genesis for this discussion. Could it be that, you know, it's really not about the tech, it's about how we interact with it, about how we think about it, and the way we think it affects us?
Yes, I think that, you know, it's possible that people are noticing that, you know, as a group, teenagers are more worried and more concerned. I mean, after all, in some ways, you know, things are harder for teenagers now than they were before. You know, there are more kids applying to college. It's more competitive. I and my colleagues joke all the time that, you know, if we were to apply to college today to the same ones we went to, we probably wouldn't get in. You know, it's harder. It's more competitive. You know, at least 50% of kids are not going to do as well, you know, economically as their parents. I mean, so that the way that this generation views the future might be really different. And so I think that because of that, people look to find reasons why that might be the case. And the rise of digital technology is one handy explanation. Whether it's related or not is not clear.
Well, you and I are old enough to remember when everyone said that TV was going to destroy our brains. And Socrates thought along the same lines about writing, but I don't have firsthand knowledge of that, just for the record.
Right.
What advice would you have for parents in dealing with teenage anxiety and our mediated culture?
So I would say that if you notice that your kids are more worried in general, you do what all parents do, which is you talk to them and you find out what they're worried about. If your sense is that there's been a change in the way they normally are, meaning they've gone from a happy-go-lucky person, well-adjusted, to being worried and anxious all the time, then I think you need to seek mental health consultation, because something is different.
We'll need to leave it there. Professor, thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Richard A. Friedman is professor of clinical psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times. He recently wrote a piece titled "The Big Myth About Teenage Anxiety." It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.